for their digestive food. So that's why we have a spread here today. I want to introduce my colleague, Dr. Lauren Farrison. Those people don't know what a neuropsychologist is, so just briefly, neuropsychology is a hybrid profession. It basically combines neurology, psychology, and psychiatry, and it addresses things in a much more subtle way than typically those separate professions do. So we catch people between the cracks and make diagnostic judgments and rehabilitative plans. The in-laws never figured out what the neuropsychologist was, but hopefully we will know. And ABEP, the American Board of Professional Psychology, is a board certification in neuropsychology. The tests themselves don't make you a neuropsychologist. It's the interpretation of the tests that make you a neuropsychologist. It's the study of brain behavioral relationships. So Dr. Lauren Farrison, when I first met her, we both had shocks on our face when we realized that we reached neuropsychologists because she's also my next door neighbor. It shows you how neuropsychologists think alike. So again, there are almost just over 1,000 neuropsychologists that are board certified in the United States and Canada. And for us to live next door to each other, you know, it's kind of remarkable. So we should have a talent. Matching my facial expressions neuropsychologist. So Dr. Lauren Farrisee is the neuropsychologist in the neuropsychology assessment program at Upstate Medical University, SUNY Upstate Medical University. She completed a PhD in clinical psychology with a specialization in neuropsychology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Then she did an internship and postdoctoral fellowship. It's a two-year postdoctoral fellowship that followed at Duke University Medical Center. She has extensive clinical experience in the assessment of neurodegenerative conditions, including Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia, which we're learning today, there are many other forms of dementia. And what she really enjoys the most, because this can be a pretty depressing thing to work with families with that kind of diagnosis, is to work on how to maximize brain health and maintain independence of living. There's going to be a follow-up on April 27th on human resources for people with dementia or other health-related conditions of aging. And so she'll explain today the various types of dementia, different types, including Alzheimer's and frontal temporal dementia, Lewy body dementia, vascular dementia, also pseudo and protective factors that you all can employ to sort of maximize brain health. So without further ado, Dr. Farrison.
Yes. Thank you so much. There you go. Everyone can hear me okay?
Yes.
All right, wonderful. And hopefully everyone on Zoom can hear me as well. So thank you so much, Alan, for having me, inviting me to speak with you today about one of my favorite topics, which is brain health, Alzheimer's disease, and other dementia. Just one additional short story about when Alan and I met. I was not board certified at the time. And I met his wife, Arlene, and she said, you know, what do you do? And I said, oh, I'm a neuropsychologist. In my next breath, I was about to tell her what neuropsychology was, and she yells out, Alan, neuropsychologist. So Alan comes over, we introduce, and his second question, I think, after where are you working, is, are you board certified? So I did finally become board certified. It's a problem. So, but I'm delighted to be here to talk to you about Alzheimer's disease, other forms of dementia. Take the next slide. I do tend to talk fast. If I'm not loud enough, if I'm too fast, just let me know. Raise your hand and tell me to slow down, speak louder, whatever it is. I don't have any. There's no conflict of interest or anything like that. I'm not funded by any drug companies. I've worked at Upstate for many years, and this talk is based on, you know, the current research, but also my extensive clinical experience. I'm not an official envoy of SUNY Upstate in this capacity. And the big point that I want to make is this presentation should not be construed as any kind of medical advice. Don't make any changes to your medications or anything like that without first talking to your health provider. All right, I'll take the next slide. So I've been working at Upstate since 2013, after I finished at Duke. And I do need to say that even though I didn't work at Duke, I am a diehard Tar Heel fan. So I'm very sad that they lost in basketball. I will root for the Tar Heels, then Syracuse, and then whoever's playing Duke. So today I'm going to be talking to you about what normal cognitive aging looks like. And then we're going to talk about what is dementia, what is the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's disease. That is a question that I get probably the most frequently in my practice, people making having difficulty making that distinction. Then we're going to talk about some other types of dementias. We're going to talk about some risk factors for dementia, later life cognitive impairment. And then what I'm really excited to talk to you about, because I feel like there's actually been some really nice work in this topic, in the last decade or so, is some mitigating factors. So, you know, it can be a little depressing. It can be a little bit scary. Everyone who comes into my office is frightened about the prospect. I'm a little frightened. That's part of why I went into this field. But there is a lot that we can do. So I hope that, you know, my take-home message will be something that is positive, something that that people can feel like this is not something that is absolutely going to happen. So we'll talk about brain health and aging. We'll talk about mitigating factors for dementia and Alzheimer's, and then we'll have time for questions. And, you know, if a question comes up in the middle, feel free to ask as well.
Going to move this closer to you. They're having trouble hearing from this end.
Oh.
So.
Is this better? Oh, now I feel like we're getting a double.
Can you speak again?
Yes. Okay. All right. How's that? Is that better on Zoom? I saw someone nodding, so that's good. All right. Okay, great. And then can I forward them from here? Or no, you still have to forward them from there. Okay. So first, in terms of normal aging, obviously there are some changes that happen as we age. I like to think of them, you know, obviously there are some things in terms of our processing speed does tend to slow down starting even as early as in our 20s. We probably have all had the experience where we can't come up with that actor's name, or we see someone in Wegmans and we know them from somewhere and we don't remember, but we can tell you who their children are. We could tell you when we last saw them. Can't come up with a name until 3 hours later, right? And then it pops up. So some delayed word retrieval, some delayed name retrieval, very, very common. There's also a decline in our ability to multitask and sort of divided attention as we age. So if we've got one thing going on, even just mentally in our head, it can be difficult to then also to process what we're doing. So this is why we end up with putting our coffee in the refrigerator instead of in the microwave, because we're thinking about something else, right? So we've all experienced that. That is normal aging. There are also some positive aspects of normal aging, right? So in terms of our judgment, our reasoning, our verbal intellect, that all tends to stay pretty stable. As we age. And of course, we also have wisdom that we develop that tends to increase as we age. I think I know for myself, I would love to have the speed of my 25-year-old brain with the wisdom of my 50-year-old brain, but that's just not.
Except not according to my millennial children. I have not
yes.
seen any wisdom.
You know, I just had my college student back. And anyway, yeah, there definitely is wisdom that comes with aging that, you know, youth is wasted on the young, right? So our ability to process what we see also tends to stay pretty stable as we age. We also all have individual strengths and weaknesses. So this is something that I try to assess in my job as a neuropsychologist. So for example, people talk about changes in word retrieval. There's changes in word retrieval and there's changes in word retrieval. So I grew up in a household where we were told, you know, my mom would say, can you please go get the thing? Well, where is it, mom? Well, it's in the other room. So, but other people have very clear very strong vocabularies. That was not the case at, you know, in my house growing up. So it's also trying to figure out the baseline, figuring out what was normal for someone. And sometimes you can get some of that information from what their profession was. So engineers will tend to be stronger in sort of more visual processing, visuospatial processing, things like that. But so you're trying to get a sense of sort of where someone was before changes started. But in terms of normal aging, the main changes are in speeded processing and in retrieval of words, pulling information back up that you hold in your brain. So I'll take the next slide. Oh, I don't want to get too close to that. It's yelling at me. Okay. So next, the big question is, okay, so what is dementia? So dementia is, it's an umbrella term that means that there's been a change in aspects of cognitive functioning, aspects of brain functioning, things like memory, language, visuospatial, executive functioning, so processing speed, judgment, reasoning, all of those types of cognitive tasks or skills. And it is significant enough that it has affected someone's ability to carry out their day-to-day functioning tasks. Okay. So this means things like, is someone having difficulty managing their finances? Are they having difficulty paying their bills? Are they making medication errors? Are they, you know, is family concerned about driving? Things like that. So we're talking about a change in daily functioning. All right, so here's my umbrella, and there's lots of different kinds of dementia. Alzheimer's is the most common kind of dementia. So everyone with Alzheimer's dementia has dementia. Not everyone with dementia has Alzheimer's, okay? And this is sort of what I do in my job, is we can use different cognitive neuropsychological tests, and different neurodegenerative disorders will have different patterns of findings. So I integrate that with the information that I get from the patient and the caregiver to try to help figure out what's going on from a diagnostic perspective. Now, dementia actually, even more broadly, can mean, again, it's that change in functioning, and that can actually be due to lots of different causes. So you can have someone who can have strokes, but there can also be some causes of dementia that actually get better over time. So we're going to set those aside for today, because what we're going to be focusing on when I talk about dementia today, it's going to be focusing on neurodegenerative dementias. So dementias that progressively get worse over time. Okay, and again, Alzheimer's is the most common one of those. I'll take the next slide. Okay, so as you can imagine, people don't go suddenly from kind of normal aging to dementia. And there's this gray area in between, kind of in the middle, that we, are you okay with the slides? I feel like I'm blocking. You're good in the back in terms of seeing? Okay. There's this gradual decline from normal aging when someone develops dementia. So we call that, that gray border area, we call that MCI, or mild cognitive impairment. So these are changes that go above and beyond normal aging, but generally the person's daily functioning is fine. So they are able to, for the most part, manage their finances. For the most part, they're able to drive safely and things like that. But there have been clear changes that, again, go above and beyond where someone should be in terms of their in terms of normal aging. And we're going to come back to this preclinical part later. So preclinical means that actually the person's functioning just fine, but there are actually pathological changes in the brain that just haven't been, we can't see them yet, or we can see them in some ways, but in terms of day-to-day functioning, there's no change. Questions about that? Does that make sense to folks? Okay. All right, I'll take the next slide. Okay, so we're going to talk about Alzheimer's dementia first, and I'm going to be very clear in talking about Alzheimer's dementia. This is what someone looks like in terms of their day-to-day functioning. I'm going to distinguish that from an underlying Alzheimer's disease a little bit later, so just hold on to kind of that thought. So right now, when we talk about Alzheimer's dementia, as I mentioned, it's the most common form of dementia, the most common form of a neurodegenerative condition. 50 to 75% of folks who are diagnosed with dementia broadly, it's Alzheimer's disease. Okay.
The most often, the most frequent presenting complaint is a change in memory. And in particular, it's short-term memory. So people will come in, they'll say, I can remember the name of my second grade teacher, but I can't, you know, I can't tell you, actually, usually it's the spouse who says, but they can't remember what they did yesterday. And the sort of prevailing characteristic is that it doesn't matter how many cues you give them, they still can't remember the information. So the information gets into the brain, but then they lose it, and no amount of cues can kind of help bring it back out. So we call that an amnestic profile. There's also often loss of insight. So it's very common for people to come in and say, my husband just doesn't, like, they're just in denial. And it's not a psychological denial in the sense that we kind of think of denial. There are actually physical changes in the brain, in the front part of the brain, that lead people with Alzheimer's dementia to not know that those changes have occurred. They truly believe that they are functioning as well as they ever have. When this happens, this is particularly difficult for the caregiver because they know that there have been these changes, but the person who is experiencing them doesn't really understand that. And again, it's not an intentional thing. It is related to these brain changes. It's kind of a blessing in a way, if you think about it, because the person doesn't have that awareness, so it's not distressing to them. Most people with Alzheimer's disease are diagnosed after the age of 65. Most people, the incidence of Alzheimer's increases as we age, and the prevalence does increase as we age. Okay? Most people are diagnosed after the age of 65. Early onset Alzheimer's disease is almost kind of a whole different animal in and of itself. So those folks can have a different cognitive profile. There can be some kind of weird and wacky findings in terms of the neuropsych, and it's much more likely to be associated with genetic factors. And we'll talk about genetic factors a little bit later, but for the most part, when folks are diagnosed in like their 50s, even early 60s, sometimes you can get some folks who are diagnosed even in their late 40s, much more likely to have a genetic piece to it. So there are these specific genetic mutations. So the amyloid precursor protein and some presenilin genes, these account for actually a very small percentage of all Alzheimer's cases. But again, just much more common when you have that early onset AD. And the neuropathology, what that means is the physical changes in the brain generally include, probably folks have heard about plaques and tangles, right? So we have beta amyloid and the tangles are tau. And so this pathology accumulates in the brain in very specific areas that lead to those changes that we see in terms of day-to-day cognitive functioning. The neuropathological changes, if you think about kind of that preclinical stage that I talked about earlier, those neuropathological changes can be present for decades, actually, before anyone develops any kind of changes to their memory or cognition. But one point that I think is really important that I want to hammer home is that some patients may never progress to having clinically detectable memory loss despite having Alzheimer's disease in their brain. Okay, so there are people where that happens. So we need to kind of keep that in mind as we think about some of the newer treatments that are available for folks.
Thank you. Good
question.
Mm-hmm.
Is it still true that definitive diagnosis can only be made post-mortem, or is that no longer?
No. Now you can do it while people are working. Yeah, we'll talk about that. Okay. Yes.
Oh, related to that. So the plaques and tangles are invariably present.
Not invariably.
Oh, okay.
No. You mean for everyone or just for patients with?
For patients with what?
For patients with biological Alzheimer's, yes. By definition, they have plaques and tangles in the brain.
Okay.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that day to day they're having memory loss.
Yeah.
And then just for the folks on Zoom, the question was, is it still true that diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease can only be made at autopsy, and that is not the case anymore. So we'll talk about that in a little bit. So I talked about some of this already. Again, the memory impairment is really sort of the cardinal feature of Alzheimer's disease. Information tends to get lost very rapidly. So I'll hear from my caregivers that, you know, he asks the same question over and over, and I kind of get the deer in the headlights look. When I say, oh, we talked about that already, so there's no sort of recognition that the conversation has occurred, especially if they're forgetting events, and that's much more concerning for me. So everybody forgets conversations because we've got other things going on in the back of our mind. But I had one wife who came in and she said, you know, my son brought home his girlfriend and we have this whole, you know, they were going to get married and it was like this whole weekend that we had together and the son completely forgot. I mean, the husband completely forgot that it had happened and couldn't recall that, you know, the name of the girlfriend, anything about her. So things like that are much more concerning than like, you know, I didn't recall that we talked about having dinner with the Smiths next Thursday. Again, there can be subtle changes in other aspects of cognition. So higher level executive functions, language, visuospatial, but memory does tend to be sort of the cardinal piece of this. As I mentioned, there can be that lack of awareness of deficits or anosognosia. There can also be mood changes that go along. That is actually not uncommon at all. I get very surprised when people are in my office and they don't have some sort of emotional response to this. When I see new onset depression, anxiety, apathy in someone who has no psych history at all, sometimes the mood changes actually can precede cognitive changes. So that kind of raises my suspicions a little bit. Later in Alzheimer's, we tend to see more of the behavioral changes that can be really concerning and problematic for caregivers. So things like a lot of paranoia, because patients with Alzheimer's might move things and forget where they put them and then feel like someone is moving things around on them or stealing money. Or they might have hallucinations, things like that, agitation, getting frustrated. That tends to happen later in the disease for sort of your typical Alzheimer's disease. One other point that I want to bring up, because I see this a lot in my practice, is that there's a lot of times a co-occurrence with vascular disease as well. And we'll talk more about kind of these vascular risk factors. But when people have things like atrial fibrillation, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, sleep apnea, we see a lot of overlap in patients with Alzheimer's disease with those comorbid medical conditions as well. So this touches on talking about before. So the underlying neuropathology does not always equal the clinical syndrome. And this is really sort of a development that's really kind of solidified in the last decade. So certainly this was something that sort of I've had to learn about compared to when I started training in the 90s. So Alzheimer's disease can now be confirmed in someone who is living. And the way that they do that is you have to have a lumbar puncture. So they put a big needle in your spinal cord and they pull out some fluid and they can see what the levels of these markers are, these proteins. And that can give us a pretty good sense of whether someone has, again, biological Alzheimer's disease. Okay. And there's lots of different biomarkers that I'm not going to get into. But again, the important thing is that right now we can determine whether someone has Alzheimer's disease through a lumbar puncture. Now, down the road, in a couple of years, we're going to have a blood test. We're going to be able to have blood biomarkers, and you will be able to go to your primary care or your neurologist and say, I need to know whether I have Alzheimer's disease, and they will be able to tell you, which is kind of amazing. But again, just to hammer this home, the presence of biological Alzheimer's does not necessarily mean that the person has clinical Alzheimer's disease dementia or even that MCI phase. Questions about that? Yes.
In general, can one person who is being clinically diagnosed with Alzheimer's, can there be a dual diagnosis? Let's say the person has Alzheimer's and Parkinson's.
That's a great question. So the question for those folks on Zoom is, can there be two diagnoses? So can someone have Alzheimer's disease and, for example, like a Parkinsonian type dementia? I would say yes. And I'll talk about this in a little bit, it is not unusual for there to be multiple pathologies that are going on in the brain. And again, that can look, sometimes it corresponds to how the person's looking clinically, but not always. So yes and no in that sense. All right, thank you. All right, so any questions about kind of Alzheimer's disease and that piece of it before we move on to some other dementias?
Yeah. I was curious, given all the controversy now with fraud, but also questioning the theory of the amyloid. Yeah. What are your thoughts as far as those biomarkers and the idea of that being biological?
Yeah. I think that they have their place. I think they can be very useful, particularly, and you have to, as you probably know, you have to have biologically confirmed Alzheimer's disease in order to take advantage of some of the newer treatments, which we'll talk about shortly. In fact, I thought I moved my slides around, but I guess I didn't. So I think there's a place for it. I think that it can be useful, but there are, and what I've learned from my cognitive neurologist colleague is that some of it depends on the lab that you're using, the specific marker, when you're doing it in the course of the patient's sort of trajectory in terms of their changes. So it's not always, oh yes, we absolutely have to get this and we're going to get this right now. So I think it's an important piece of the puzzle and I'm happy that we have it. As a piece of information, but it's certainly not kind of the end all be all in terms of Alzheimer's disease.
So just to clarify possibly, if there is an interaction, if you have the biomarker, let's say the blood work done, the labs and all that, it was going, APOE?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we're going to talk about that as well. And maybe I don't know if I should skip ahead to treatment, but I promise we'll get there. We'll talk about the treatment specifically for Alzheimer's disease and how that all fits in. Because that's been the big development in the last couple of years is treatment for that. So yes, I promise we will come back to that. I do want to touch on other kinds of dementia. So Alzheimer's, you know, is the big one, but there's a lot of other different kinds of dementias, neurodegenerative dementias. I'm not going to get into there's many. I'm going to focus on some of the ones that are the most common. So frontotemporal dementias tend to, as the name says, affect the front part, the frontal lobes and the temporal lobes of the brain. And I'm going to talk about two of them. So the first one is behavioral variant FTD. That tends to really significantly affect the front part of the brain. The front part is really important for judgment, social behavior. Our filter, if we have one, is in there. And then primary progressive aphasia, which actually there's several different kinds, but we're going to focus on a couple of them. That tends to be more language predominant and tends to, again, affect more of the temporal lobe. So we'll touch on those. Important to know is that the onset typically is earlier than Alzheimer's disease. So these are folks who tend to be in their 50s, early 60s. A lot of times they're still working. It can be really, these are sad cases. These are challenging. It is often misdiagnosed for several years. So I can't tell you the number of folks that have been misdiagnosed with depression or even with late onset bipolar disorder. And it turns out actually they have a frontotemporal dementia. And it is often associated with tau pathology. So Alzheimer's, you know, there's amyloid and tau pathology. This tends to be more heavier in the tau. Next slide.
Technology.
It's okay. I'll start talking anyway. So we're going to talk next about the behavioral variant of FTD, which is the most common variant. Behavioral variant FTD is the early symptoms are really in changes in social behavior. Yeah, we're good. Social behavior and personality. And this really is a pretty marked change. So I remember quite clearly a case that I had on postdoc where the husband was in his late 50s and the wife was like, yeah, he's, you know, been acting a little bit strange. But the thing that really got me concerned was they went to this dinner party and he walked over, there was like a whole table of tea sandwiches. And he walked over and he picked up a couple tea sandwiches. He opened them up, he licked out the filling, and then he put the bread back on the table. And she was like, okay, we've got some issues here. So disinhibition, you can also see, again, those changes in kind of social behaviors. Now, again, this is where it's really helpful to know how someone was before this all started. So some people have never had a filter. Some people have always sort of said whatever came out and no regard for whether it's hurting someone's feelings, for example. So helpful to get a sense of whether there's been a change. But there can also be this sort of lack of initiation, lack of motivation. Another example that comes to mind is this, and I'm sorry that it actually is more prevalent in men than women, but all my examples are men. Sorry. It was this grandfather who was supposed to go pick up his grandkids and he forgot. And his wife was like, "You left the kids at school for like 2 hours." And he was like, "Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay." Just no, and that was extremely uncharacteristic for him. He was a very kind, empathic person. So we can also see sort of the other side of the coin, which is sort of hyper orality, hypersexuality, hyper religiosity. So sometimes you will have individuals who start, they have these massive changes in their food preferences where they'll start eating tons of ice cream, or they never had a sweet tooth before, or and suddenly watching porn and they never watched porn before. So these just really marked changes in behavior and social functioning. Again, this often gets misdiagnosed for years as depression or another psychiatric disorder. A neuropsych exam actually can sometimes be pretty normal. We might see some mild weaknesses in executive functioning, but that's, again, I always say neuropsych is one piece of the puzzle. And the MRI, the brain scan, can show some atrophy, some shrinkage in the front parts of the brain. All right, so this is just a very busy slide. And what I just really want to emphasize here is if we have behavioral variant FTD, and that's sort of the clinical syndrome that we see in the person's day-to-day functioning, these can all be neuropathological changes. These are all different markers that might be abnormal in someone who clinically is presenting as behavioral variant FTD. So again, the point is that there can be, there might be multiple genes that are affecting this. There might be different ones that lead to the same clinical syndrome. So just a lot of heterogeneity in terms of that underlying neuropathology. And ultimately, I mean, we care about what is going on in the brain, but ultimately this is a person in front of us and we have to help people function in their daily lives. We have to help the families and help the patients function in their daily lives as best they can. Thanks. Okay. Any questions about FTD? So I'm just going to touch on primary progressive aphasia. This sometimes will get grouped in terms of the clinical syndromes and sometimes gets grouped in terms of the pathology. So there's one that I actually don't talk about that actually is called locopenic PPA that actually tends to have more Alzheimer's pathology. These two tend to be more frontal, which is why they're grouped kind of with the frontal temporal dementias. The language changes are really the earliest sign in these patients. So in a non-fluent PPA, someone might really have difficulty physically getting the words out. So they have difficulty with coming up with words, but also the physical pronunciation of the words is affected. Memory and other cognitive abilities might actually be okay. They might be able to function pretty well. They understand, but they just might not be able to speak well or clearly. Semantic PPA is another variant that can present with word finding difficulty. The cardinal feature is that they lose the meaning of the object. And I had a farmer many years ago who, this was when I was in North Carolina. His wife was like, "Oh, you know, it seems like it's time for you to start the planting. Like, have you planted the cucumbers yet?" And he said, "What's a cucumber?" So he just completely lost the meaning. It wasn't that he couldn't come up with the word cucumber. He did not know what it was. Okay. So again, we'll see kind of clear changes in language early on in PPA patients.
Question.
Yes.
What you just described, is that different than Wernicke or Broca's aphasia?
So Broca's aphasia sort of overlaps a little bit with that non-fluent PPA. Wernicke's tends to be more receptive language. There's difficulty, you know, with comprehension that tends to overlap a little bit more with like the locopenic, but not entirely. All right, so Lewy body dementia, I feel like has been has increase in popularity is not exactly the right phrase, but we know a lot more now about doing
public
that.
Awareness.
More public awareness. Thank you. That's the phrase I'm looking for. See, I've got some word finding issues myself. But again, I grew up with, I had to go get the thing in the other room. So there are, we understand a lot more about, again, sort of the pathology of Lewy body. So it's called Lewy body dementia because the pathology are these Lewy bodies that that accumulate in the brain. And this Lewy body dementia, there tends to be cognitive changes, but really there are these other features that are really kind of core clinical features. So there can be Parkinsonism, and we separate that is different than Parkinson's disease, although there is some overlap. But Parkinsonism, there tends to be rigidity. There can be tremor, but it's more likely to be bilateral. It's more likely to be in both hands instead of one. So you can see these kind of motor changes in that regard. One of the biggest sort of clear indicators that you might be seeing someone with Lewy body dementia actually is recurrent visual hallucinations. So one of the screening questions that I ask my patient is, have you noticed any, well, I would say, you know, you see things that other people don't see, but like any children playing in your basement that actually aren't there? Or are you seeing people in your backyard that, you know, your wife says actually aren't there? Usually these actually are not distressing to the patient, but they're definitely there. So that can be, and again, this isn't someone who has no psychiatric history whatsoever, right? So this is not someone who's had schizophrenia for many years or has a history of visual hallucinations. This is new. There can also be fluctuations in cognition. And what I mean by this is person seems totally fine at one point, and then even within minutes or hours, they can be completely flustered. It might seem like they're having a stroke or a seizure, and then they kind of pop back. And some of those fluctuations in cognition is another cardinal kind of core feature for Lewy body. And then the other one that I think is really interesting is what's called REM behavior disorder. So, what this means is that during sleep, the person might, so we all dream when we sleep, but what happens in REM behavior disorder is the brain's ability to kind of shut down movement declines, and so people act out their dreams. And so what can happen is they smack their spouse, they are yelling and talking and really kind of acting out what's going on in their dreams. Okay. This can actually precede cognitive symptoms by decades. So it's a risk factor for later development of Lewy body dementia. So not everyone who has REM behavior disorder will develop Lewy body dementia, but most people who have Lewy body dementia at some point have had REM behavior disorder.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that REM behavior disorder also a sign of a precursor of Parkinson's disease?
It can be, yes. So there is a lot of overlap with that as well. So I would say it is a sensitive indicator, but it's not specific. There's lots of other reasons why someone can have REM behavior disorder. Okay. So also there's some SSRI, so some medications, some of the antidepressants, common antidepressants can lead to vivid dreams and actually can lead to some of these same symptoms. Okay. Parkinson's disease as well, and then also narcolepsy can you can see these behaviors.
What type of antidepressants?
SSRIs in particular. So those are kind of the core clinical features. You have,
A goofy question, but what about a person with a history, especially a childhood history, sleepwalking?
That's a great question. So the question for folks on Zoom is, what about folks who had a childhood history of sleepwalking and other sleep disordered behaviors? I don't know. Do you know that? I'm not sure, actually.
I don't see any correlation between the two.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not sure about like the world of sleep, but
that's great.
Yeah.
I used to walk home.
You have places to go, right?
You're living evidence that there's no correlation.
Yes.
So far.
All right. So we need at least two of these four clinical features in order to be diagnosed with Lewy body dementia. There are also a number of supportive clinical features. So things like autonomic dysfunction, if there's low blood pressure, erectile dysfunction, incontinence, that can be supportive, but in and of itself is not going to be enough. There's a real clear, it doesn't happen with everyone, but when it does, it's pretty striking, and that's a sensitivity to antipsychotic medication. So sometimes, I don't know if anyone's a primary care provider in this room, but sometimes what'll happen, I see this, is the person will develop visual hallucinations, and the primary care trying to be helpful puts them on an antipsychotic, and it makes it worse. So that's actually a pretty good indicator that you're dealing with nonfiction. Okay. There can also be a lot of falls, changes in balance, loss of smell is very common. It's also common in Parkinson's disease. It's also common in Alzheimer's disease. So again, a supportive clinical feature, but not something that's going to be specific to Lewy body. And there can also be other hallucinations or other sort of what we call neuropsychiatric symptoms. So one of the one that we tend to see is called Capgras syndrome, and that is when a person believes that their spouse has been replaced by an exact replica of their spouse. So they will come home and they will say, like, where's the real John?
Yeah.
I am your husband. We've been married for, 40 years. No, you're not. And actually one of the behavioral techniques, I think, for that is for the person, for the spouse to actually leave the house, drive around, come back and be like, no, I'm the real John. And sometimes that will actually help the patient then be like, oh, okay. In terms of the neuropsych, we tend to see a lot more of like the visuospatial, the executive speeded processing weaknesses. We can see some memory changes, but usually it's much less than we see in an Alzheimer's patient. And I think like folks were referring to, there can be a lot of overlap with Parkinson's disease. And kind of as a side note, people who have Parkinson's disease and have had Parkinson's disease for many years may go on to develop dementia. When that happens, we call it Parkinson's disease dementia.
Okay.
So there can be a lot of overlap, and some of this is kind of which came first. And I think there's a lot of overlap again in terms of the neuropathology as well.
Mm-hmm.
But usually the folks with Parkinson's disease dementia have had Parkinson's disease for many, many years before they develop that cognitive decline. Questions about that? Okay, so vascular cognitive impairment. This is kind of the last diagnostic category I'm going to talk about. And the reason I'm going to talk about it is because I feel like in 90% of my patients, there's a vascular piece to it. So in terms of day-to-day function or day-to-day kind of how people are, actual people, we see this a lot. So vascular cognitive impairment, and I want to distinguish a little bit. So you can have sort of vascular dementia when you have someone who's had multiple strokes, and after each stroke, maybe they decline a little bit, and you get this kind of stepwise fashion. But what I see much more in my practice are folks who have vascular risk factors. So things like high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, sleep apnea that's not treated, cardiac disease, atrial fibrillation, stroke, all those kinds of things, all those vascular risk factors. And when those, sometimes even when they are treated, we still see changes in the brain. These are typically referred to as white matter ischemic changes. And it can range from mild, very mild, moderate, severe. Generally, when we see moderate to severe white matter changes in the brain, we tend to see more changes in terms of day-to-day functioning, but not always. I have looked at brains where I am amazed at the extensive white matter changes that this person is doing their own finances, they're driving, there's no change whatsoever, they're functioning just fine. I've also had the opposite, where someone had sort of a strategic white matter blip in one spot and it seems like they kind of fall apart. So it doesn't always correspond, but we tend to see more changes in sort of speeded processing. I would say the white matter is sort of the superhighway in the brain, superhighways. It kind of connects everything together. So if information can't get quickly from point A to point B and it has to go to point C first, it's going to take a little longer. So we're going to see some changes in word retrieval and speeded processing, things like that. It can co-occur with neurodegenerative pathology. So it is rare, I feel like, that I see someone where I'm like, this is Alzheimer's, it's only Alzheimer's, there's nothing else going on. Usually it's Alzheimer's, oh, and then maybe we have a few blips here and there, and I think that it's probably related to some vascular changes as well. It's less likely to cause sort of a traditional dementia, but what I feel like it does is, and we see this a lot with Alzheimer's disease, because they kind of, there's sort of a synergistic relationship. Someone has Alzheimer's, they might be sort of the vascular burden might affect them a little bit more. So we might see a faster decline than someone like that. And then someone who has vascular disease, by the time they get that Alzheimer's pathology, it might sort of be the straw that breaks the camel's back. There can also be behavior changes. There can also be mood changes. So vascular is kind of like it's everything and it's nothing. That makes sense. Any questions about that? Yes.
So if the vascular pathology is treated successfully, mm-hmm. that oftentimes in a case like this, ameliorate the cognitive symptoms, the cognitive deficiencies?
That's a great question. I need to go back to sort of, so the question was if you can sort of better control the vascular risk factors, is it possible to ameliorate some of those physical brain changes? I would need to read up again on sort of the stability of white matter changes over time. My impression clinically is that you can kind of stabilize things. I don't necessarily see people get better, but they might stabilize, they might come up with compensatory strategies to maximize their functioning, but they're not going to be able to make those changes go away.
Yeah, they're not reversible, you know, is yeah. what you're saying. But, you know, I'd ask you to just touch on why it's important to make these differential diagnoses in terms of longitudinal progression rates.
Yes.
Another question about, what if someone had, a major concussion as a child, mm-hmm. as an adolescent? Are they more likely to have this kind of condition later in life?
They might. It depends on the severity. We'll talk about some risk factors shortly. So, yeah. So I guess I think of this as sort of an additional set of risk factors. So, you know, in terms of the vascular piece of it, we want these, ideally, people won't develop these, but if they do, we want them to be tightly controlled. If you have sleep apnea, we want you to wear your CPAP or get some sort of device because that can, again, kind of stabilize and hopefully decrease the impact that that's going to have on your later trajectory of cognitive change from dementia. Okay, so again, just a brief review of these different syndromes. So Alzheimer's more likely to start with memory loss, Lewy body more likely to start with kind of motor symptoms or these neuropsychiatric changes, the frontotemporal more likely to be changes in language or social behavior. Primary vascular is going to be, again, more likely to follow from a stroke. But again, keeping in mind that this sort of vascular cognitive impairment can kind of confer additional risk for folks who might have an underlying neuropathology as well.
One point though, mm-hmm. you know, they're not necessarily strokes that are detectable. They're very mini strokes
yes.
called lacunar infarctions, and they add up over time. So the more of these little areas and what happens,
exactly.
right, what happens with these little strokes is that the area of brain surrounding that area is not getting nutrients and therefore dies off. And the more of that, the more impact, it's like craters on the moon, you know, the more impact craters, the more deficient the
yeah.
person's
coming. And the harder it is for different parts of the brain to communicate, right? So if there's less tissue there, truly like fewer neurons, mm-hmm. then you can't make connections.
So they never detected a stroke. No one, they don't know that they've had strokes. They're not diagnosed
yeah.
that they have strokes.
Yeah, exactly. So this is not something, yeah. Exactly. So people aren't going into the hospital thinking that a stroke. Yeah.
So if you've been told you have white matter disease, is that a precursor to the vascular dementia?
Not necessarily. It might be, but it might not be. Yep.
And to take it forward at that time, the the reintroduction of neurotransmitter medications such as dopamine and acetylcholine to enhance that nourishment.
So that gets to whether you take a cholinesterase inhibitor, which I think is what you're getting at for vascular changes. And we'll touch on that in a little bit. I will say I see it all the time. I don't know that it actually helps. Well, the next one. Okay, so now we're going to talk about treatment of Alzheimer's disease. So this is where we've really seen some pretty significant developments in the last decade. So cholinesterase inhibitors are the oral medications that I'm not seeing the TV commercials as much nearly anymore. But for a while, there were a lot of commercials about Aricept or donepezil. Some of the other ones are rivastigmine, galantamine. And then memantine or Namenda is actually only, I think, you could correct me if I'm wrong, Alan, but I think it's only FDA approved for moderate to severe Alzheimer's disease. And the number of patients that I see who come and who maybe have MCI and they're on Namenda drives me nuts. But so anyway.
Really, these are overdiagnosed. They're overprescribed.
Absolutely. But. Where's my overprescribed? I've got that on another slide. So I see that so much and it drives me crazy. But anyway. We get this prescription cascade. But so now we've got these monoclonal antibody treatments. So these are the ones that have come out in the last 2 years. There was a big controversy, lecanemab, donanemab, one of them Aduhelm, which I can't remember the, it's also a mAb, was pulled from the market. These are infusions. They're given 1 to 2 times a month. They are only approved, if you think again about that graph that I have with kind of the staging of Alzheimer's disease, it's only approved for folks, or it was only tested, I should say, on folks who had MCI, mild cognitive impairment, or mild Alzheimer's disease, okay? And what it does is it clears the amyloid protein from the brain. So that sounds awesome, right? Like it's actually a disease-modifying treatment. In theory, I mean, well, it does it in practice, but the problem with it is that sometimes day to day, patients don't notice a difference. And there's a pretty significant side effect profile. So one of the side effects that happens is bleeding in the brain and these additional white matter. So you can have hemorrhaging, microhemorrhaging, or you can have these additional white matter changes in the brain. And it's not an insignificant minority of patients. I think it's like 20 to 30%. And we're going to touch on ApoE, which is another risk factor for Alzheimer's. And the sad thing is that people who actually have an allele of ApoE, that means that they're more likely to have Alzheimer's disease, unfortunately, also means that they're more likely to get these side effects of the brain. So when we talk about, you know, treatments for Alzheimer's disease, it's a step, but it's certainly not the end all be all, unfortunately. So, but it is an option. Questions about that? Anything that you wanted to add about that?
Well, all these medications have side effects. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as just mentioned, you know, it's overprescribed and you really don't see much of a difference. Another point to make is that the actual brain architecture isn't a determination of what the function is. And you can see that even in the developmental literature. Very famous pediatric neurologist, Isabel Rappin, showed before they had MRIs, they had pneumoencephalograms. And they showed this one individual who had just very little cortex. And you would think that person would be in a assisted living kind of situation. He was an honor student at Cornell. So some people who have really ugly brains can function very well. And people who have pristine looking brains don't function well. So there's more to it than simply looking at this. And one of the things you didn't mention was PET scans, which, you know, show the metabolism of what goes on in different brain regions.
Yeah.
What are some side effects of the cholinesterase?
GI issues. So a lot of times folks will have diarrhea or loose stools, particularly early on. Sometimes they can have vivid dreams or kind of things like that. I think those are the two most common. The GI stuff in particular, I have a lot of patients who can't tolerate it. No.
One other point that these new drugs, and there's a lot of money involved in the manufacture of these new drugs.
Yes.
While it can eliminate amyloid, it doesn't necessarily mean that the patient improves from eliminating the amyloid. So there are many different components. You know, we tend to give diseases names, you know, just like in schizophrenia or in any of these dementing disorders, but there is subtle subtypes. And while many patients have tau and have amyloid problems, not everybody with tau and amyloid problems has clinical symptoms, and eliminating those don't necessarily improve everybody. And the same thing with biomarkers, by the way.
Yes.
You know, there's a lot of controversy as to whether these biomarkers are very specific.
Yes. Yeah.
So the final chapter has not been written yet for these biomarkers.
Exactly. Yeah. All right. So treatments for other neurodegenerative dementias, kind of limited. We do know actually one of the cholinesterase inhibitors, rivastigmine, actually works pretty well with Lewy body dementia. It actually tends to work better than with patients with Alzheimer's disease, from what I've heard. And of course, avoiding antipsychotics so you don't increase the psychiatric symptoms. For behavioral variant FTD, a lot of times SSRIs are helpful, but for the most part, we're trying to manage those symptoms. So symptoms are, you know, whatever's coming out in terms of impeding the, quality of life or day-to-day functioning, that's what we're going to be focused on treating. And thinking about, you know, behavioral changes as well, right? Or behavioral modifications that families can make that can really impact a person's behavior. So we don't always have to do medications, right? There's a lot of emphasis. I feel like this was actually one nice thing about the pandemic is I feel like a lot of people went and started, you know, podcasts and things like that. So I recently learned about this. It's focused on dementia caregivers. Actually, Ellen, if you're not familiar with it, I'll send you the link. And it talks about specific strategies that you can use to help when patients have full-blown dementia and their behaviors are changing. It's a communication, right? So people are getting agitated because they're trying to communicate to you, and figuring out what that means and why can be helpful. As Ellen mentioned, in my opinion, Aricept and memantine are overdiagnosed. So what happens, what I see a lot is, say someone is on a ton of medications that can cause cognitive issues. And then they come in and they're like, well, I'm having all these memory issues. So then they get put on Aricept and memantine, and then they're on even more medications. So I will have folks come into my office. I'm like, show me your med list, 30 medications. I'm like, it's amazing that you're... Please don't drive. That happens a lot. You know, people mean well. And again, I always say I'm a PhD, not an MD, and I don't prescribe yet. I will at some point. I have to go, we'll work on that. But I do think that there is a lot of overprescribing of these medications. And I think providers mean well, right? They're trying to help their patients as best they can, but I think it unfortunately can make things worse. Yeah.
In these neurodegenerative disorders that we're talking about, is there any implication of autoimmune?
That's a great question. So the question for the Zoom folks is there any implication for autoimmune? I don't know. I know there's questions about sort of inflammation and sort of how that plays into Alzheimer's pathology and things like that. But I don't know of any like overlap in terms of treatments, or I know there's stuff in sort of the clinical trials pipeline, but beyond that, I'm not sure. Anything that you wanted to add to that?
I think it's a good question. I think that someday they'll show that, but there's no literature on that at this point.
There's no literature on that at this point,
but I think there's always subgroups of individuals where, autoimmune pathology would play a role in terms of destruction of brain tissue. You know, there are so many autoimmune disorders, and many of these autoimmune disorders are neurological, for example, you know.
Yeah, so for someone with like multiple sclerosis, it's unlikely. A lot of times those folks have cognitive changes. We see a lot of MS folks in our clinic, but they don't typically have sort of what you would conceptualize as dementia.
So the fallback to be inflammation.
Yeah, and we will see. It's not. I mean, I have seen patients who have full on MS dementia, but it's not neurodegenerative in the way that these are neurodegenerative. If that makes sense.
Dr. Farisi hasn't mentioned it, but you know there are many other reversible kinds of dementias due to endocrine disorders, for example, that affect brain function. And so there are conditions, but it's not part of this presentation because she's focusing on primary progressive dementias, but there are reversible dementias.
Yeah. And a lot of times there's, you know, problems with like lab work, metabolic things like that, where they can be reversible. Not Alzheimer's, alcohol, for example, would be another one where sometimes you can see some reversible. All right, so now we're going to shift to talking about, I'm like way past time, aren't I? Risk factors for Alzheimer's disease and dementia. So aging is the big one, right? So we all age, our brains age, we're more likely to develop dementia as we age. Head trauma and traumatic brain injury is a big one. I feel like the jury's still out a little bit. We know that it can, again, increase risk, but the way that it increased risk has a lot to do with the severity of the brain injury. If someone has a mild concussion in their teens, 20s, whatever, kids hit their heads, they get bonks on the head, we're not concerned about that, even though there's so much more emphasis now and focus on, you know, concussions, particularly with regards to sports and things like that. So that's still, I'm not going to get into the whole CTE thing right now, but it is a risk factor, I would say. Cerebrovascular disease, as we've talked about. Also, you can sometimes see folks, this is kind of another straw that can break the camel's back. If you have someone who develops sepsis or a UTI or some sort of acute medical condition, sometimes when folks undergo general anesthesia for a surgery, it could kind of throw things over the edge and they can then develop some cognitive impairment after that. We also have lower educational level. So educational level is a protective factor. So folks who have higher levels of education are thought to have higher cognitive reserve. It's a proxy. And what that means is the brain can kind of take more hits before we see changes to daily functioning. Family history as well. So when there's a first degree relative who has had Alzheimer's disease, again, it increases the risk. It's not determinative, doesn't mean you're absolutely going to get it, but it can increase the risk. And then medications, I see this a lot. Again, there's the benzodiazepines, the anticholinergics, antihistamines. So here is one place where I will say, if you're taking a over-the-counter sleep medicine like Benadryl or anything like that, it's not good. Not good once you're 60. It can really increase cognitive clarity, increase falls, increase. What we don't know is when people get off it, whether it decreases the risk. But those are all risk factors. All right, I'll take the next slide. Okay, so this we touched on a little bit before, but that early onset AD more likely to have sort of a deterministic genetic component. So if you have this gene, you will get it. What is more common are things like APOE. If you have the E4 allele, it increases your likelihood of developing Alzheimer's disease down the road. But 40% of those with at least one E4 allele do not get AD dementia. And you'll notice I highlighted the dementia part. So again, you can have those neuropathological changes in the brain, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you will have changes in your day-to-day function. Okay. So now what do we do about this? So now that we know, now that I'm like doom and gloom, all these terrible things are going to happen, what can we do? So there was a recent paper last year in Lancet that talked about that for up to 40% of late life cognitive decline or dementia actually can be attributed to a combination of the following factors. So what we can do then is look at all these factors and see which ones we can control, right? So we probably can't control our educational attainment, like we've done what we've done, right? But things like high blood pressure, obesity, diabetes, again, a lot of those vascular risk factors that we see in there, those are factors that we can change to some extent. There's genetic predisposition, of course, to elevated cholesterol, things like that. But we have some agency here. Things like hearing loss. I really need to get my hearing checked. If you can't hear, you're not going to be able to learn the information. You're not going to be able to pull it back out. So get hearing aids. For people who are smoking, decreasing smoking or stopping smoking. If people are drinking too much alcohol, we decrease alcohol. These are all things that we can do that we have control over. Physical inactivity and social isolation are two huge ones. People who are sedentary, who do not engage in physical activity, have higher rates of dementia and Alzheimer's disease. I always tell my patients, you don't have to run a marathon, but dance in your living room, park a little farther away in Wegman, you know, from your Wegman's parking lot, take the stairs, whatever you can do. If you have physical things like a bad hip, bad ankle, get PT so that you can get moving. Doesn't matter what you do. Find something you love doing it and do it. Social isolation. This was huge with COVID. I can't tell you how many patients came into my office. Mom was doing just fine until she couldn't go to her bridge group and she couldn't see her ladies for lunch on Wednesdays. She could go to the hairdresser and things plummeted. So we're learning more and more that social engagement is super important and actually can be a protective factor. Okay, so we're going to control what we can control and go from there. Questions about these? Yeah.
Sorry, you didn't have any of the medications there as mitigating risk, like getting off of certain meds?
Yes, that is something, absolutely, yeah. So
that would be sleeping pills?
Yes, sleeping pills, Benadryl, any kind of over-the-counter allergy medicines also aren't great, some
like
of them.
Like Allegra's or Pet?
Yeah, some of them are worse than others, but generally if you don't need them, it's mm-hmm. good to get off them. There's a lot of meds for urinary incontinence, in particular like Deptral, oxybutynin. Those are highly anticholinergic and can really sort of mimic Alzheimer's disease. Pain medications, gabapentin. There have been some issues with that. I've seen a lot of folks with that who it's led to some cognitive changes. There's some headache medications like Topamax that can be problematic as well. For folks who are interested in kind of looking into that, there's a great resource called the BEERS criteria, B-E-E-R-S, and it's a list of medications that are not appropriate for people over the age of 60 that should be prescribed with great caution. So this is really kind of my positive message going forward. So what can we do? We talked a little bit about this, but just remembering your heart health is your brain health. So anything that's good for your heart is going to be good for your brain. Managing those vascular risk factors, avoiding those over-the-counter sleep meds, trying to maximize sleep using behavioral strategies, so limiting caffeine before, you know, stopping drinking caffeine at noon or 2 o'clock. Our ability to metabolize caffeine changes as we age. Trying to, you know, make your bedroom someplace that's calming can be helpful, things like that. Exercise, really a big one. If there's one thing that I want to really emphasize, it's, and you want to try to get cardio and you want to try to get strength, any way that you can kind of move your body is really important. We didn't even, I'm sorry, I ran a little bit over, but nutrition is also a piece of it. I always say there's no like one magic food, except maybe blueberries, so go to Costco, get your blueberries. There's a diet called the MIND diet, which is, Mediterranean Dash Intervention for Delay of Neurodegenerative, or for Mediterranean Intervention for Delay of Neurodegenerative Delay. All right, well, too many words in there. But basically you want to, I like to tell people, instead of saying, don't eat this, don't eat this, don't eat this, how about just increase fruits and veggies? Focus on that first as like something you can do, right? So lots of veggies, dark leafy greens, lots of legumes, minimizing red meat, kind of what you'd expect, right? And again, mm-hmm. fried chicken every now and then if you want to have fried chicken, but kind of focusing on it overall. Limiting processed foods, limiting fried foods, limiting red meat. These are all things that, again, are associated with lower rates of dementia and Alzheimer's disease. Social interaction and cognitively challenging activities. Find something that works for you that's fun. I had so many patients come in the office and were like, I hate crossword puzzles, but I have to do it every day so that I don't get dementia. I'm like, no, I'm like, find another kind of puzzle that you like to do that. It's not crossword puzzles that you have to do. And I always tell people, don't take Prevagen, spend that money on like a gym membership or go spend time with your grandkids. Like that's really important. And that actually might be protective as well. And then my final point that I want to have you take home, again, individuals who have a healthy lifestyle, what you can do, again, if you're going to get it, you might get it. But what you can do is there's some ability, we have some agency in order to sort of shift the onset, right? So maybe by focusing on some of these factors, we're getting it at 90 instead of 85, or we're getting it at 80 instead of 75. And again, it's sort of the social interaction, cognitively stimulating activities, physical exercise, balanced diet. We know all of those things. If we can do a couple of those, that's going to be more likely to affect our day-to-day and our risk down the road. Limit long-term use of benzos and over-the-counter sleep meds. Didn't even touch on alcohol, but limiting alcohol, engaging in regular physical exercise, prioritizing socializing. And also, it's never too late to start, right? Like we have agency here, and there are things that we can do to kind of shift our risk on the margins. And my final thing that I want you to take home is don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Okay, so there's no like magical way. People can do everything right, and they still get Alzheimer's disease. They still might get another kind of dementia. But we got to at least try, and there's lots of things that we can't do. Yeah.
I have actually a personal question. My mother-in-law, suffering from dementia, and we moved her from one assisted living to another in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And She hated it. She didn't eat for 2 days. And within 2 weeks, she really deteriorated. In other words, her memory was sort of, but you know, she
her
wasn't making sense.
Yep.
She couldn't get, she needed help. Now, talk about progression, but is that common?
Yes.
Trauma can.
Yes.
Can
so if there's a change, or like if there's a hospitalization, again, it kind of can depend on what stage people are at. Mm-hmm. But if she's very confused about where she is in this,
she's not confused.
Okay.
She's angry.
She's angry. Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She said, I want to go. You know,
yeah.
But we had to move her because where she was, she would have had a full time aide to stay there.
Uh-huh.
This is a better care facility for that. She still has an aide.
Yeah.
Like the first 2 weeks were terrible.
Yeah.
And then she just sort of, as
was
the
she, able
say,
to
she sort of benched out. You know,
okay.
she talks, but
yeah.
she always forgot, but she forgets now the names of her friendship.
Yeah. It's not unusual when there's like a change in environment that there we can see some more significant change.
Stress affects brain function.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's a general negative for any kind of health factor. So stress is important. And one thing that it's helpful in terms of mitigation things are new tasks rather than follow routines to engage in new task activities.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something. But also before you leave and finish, just touch on the different rates of progression for the different subtypes. Why it makes sense to differentiate the different diagnoses between Alzheimer's and multi-infarct and so.
Yeah. So Alzheimer's disease, generally earlier folks who are diagnosed with these early onset dementias tend to progress more quickly. Folks who are like kind of best case scenario for someone with Alzheimer's is 80 with like higher level of education. It can be a pretty slow progression. We don't tend to see actually fairly rapid rate. So but there's, I always say I don't have a crystal ball. There can be a lot of variability in terms of, you know, an individual person and how they're going to decline. But generally folks who are younger, again, I feel like there's kind of a lot of different factors that can feed into that. Yeah.
I just want to mention how important the exercise piece is.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a caregiver for both my parents and got them involved in a research program through Upstate for Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
And the deal was, for 6 months, they went 3 days a week for a little bit of exercise. I say a little bit. It was based on their heart rate.
Mm-hmm.
They had to get their heart rate up to a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout this process, throughout the time period of the program, periodically they re-cognitive tested
uh-huh.
both of them. Now, my mom didn't have a dementia at that point.
Mm-hmm.
My dad clearly did.
Mm-hmm.
It really made such a difference for both of them in their cognitive ability, so much so that they extended them for another like 6 months in that program because it was such, you know, such a profound difference in both of them.
That's great.
So it's not like they were running. My dad was 87, 88.
Yeah.
It wasn't running around the track, but they were both walking together.
Yeah.
Around the track, there was a nurse checking on them, making sure their heart rate got to a certain point.
Yeah.
And when that happened, they were okay, you can go home now.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. What it does is it's increasing oxygenation in the brain, right? Like you have to be able to have the blood flow in the brain in order to use it. So that's at least one mechanism by which exercise can be.
And the last thing, I mentioned this to you earlier before, uh-huh. but for the benefit of everybody else, with my mom, it was more of a depression after my dad passed away, but she wouldn't drink, so she'd get dehydrated. And we were weekly at the hospital because of UTIs.
Yeah.
And I was told by one of the nurses there, hey, she just needs to get hydrated. You need to, if you could figure out how to get these people, because there was a whole line of seniors from Menorah Park, they're needing to be rehydrated. So I found a place that would just do a 500 milliliter saline solution. And it was like magic.
Yeah.
I'd pick her up and she'd be dragging her feet. An hour later, we go back to the place and she's skipping through the halls. Big, big difference. And she was not someone who would drink. She'd fake drink. She'd stick her tongue in it. Okay, that was so good. But she wouldn't drink. But that was the death of her. That made it terrible. She couldn't figure out how to use the phone. It would get very bad very quickly.
Yeah.
Hydration is huge.
Absolutely.
So,
yes.
A question about the linear quality, right, in these dementias.
the question, even if you see someone in decline,
mm-hmm.
and it seems generally linear,
mm-hmm.
and they're losing function in a number of different areas, can there also be sort of these almost like a loose light bulb moment where suddenly, like, I don't know, in the middle of a week, someone seems better, you know, that sure. kind of quality? I'm just curious.
Absolutely.
About
that. So the question was related to sort of small improvements in the course of this linear decline. Absolutely. So there's going to be all these other factors, right, that are going to affect someone's day-to-day function. Did they sleep well? Did they have enough hydration?
Right.
Did they eat well? So all those kinds of issues are going to contribute to someone sort of day-to-day.
Shifts,
absolutely.
Right, someone's
yeah.
suddenly overplayed like themselves
yeah.
today.
Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. If it's extreme, then I would start
that's
wondering
different.
Actually about like a Lewy body,
that's
you know, whether that's a piece
right.
of it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Are there cultural differences in the rates of these different kinds of dementias?
Fantastic question.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic question. So my knowledge of, so I know that, for example, so are you thinking cultural sort of broadly in terms of the world, like different
yeah.
countries?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's a good question. I think some of it is related, my understanding is, so I know, for example, in this country, there's higher rates, there can be higher rates of like cerebrovascular cognitive impairment in Blacks. And some of that is related to some underlying, they have higher rates of obesity and diabetes and sort of those vascular risk factors. And so then that can increase the likelihood that they then develop Alzheimer's disease down the line. So I know there's higher rates there. I'm not sure like worldwide, but I think some of that might be more related again to kind of these more of these like vascular comorbidities and other health conditions. You know anything else?
So the answer is the racial differences, you know, based on different diets, for example, the Japanese have different diets.
Yeah.
But I don't think there are cultural differences, you know.
Or demographic differences.
Demographic differences,
yeah.
yes.
Education differences.
Yes. Then again, that's like a protected
right.
route, right? Yeah. Other questions?
More. I have a question, but just more, much more general.
Yeah.
I refer a lot of people to university geriatricians.
Yes.
When would be a good idea to just direct them to the neuropsych assessment? So.
I would say, so the question was, you know, for referrals to geriatrics versus to neuropsych, I would say if they're already sort of managed well by their primary care, or like, you know, it's probably more on a case-by-case basis. Maybe if they have like a neurologist who you feel like is generally caring for them well and they, but they need more information about whether it's, you know, if it's like a depression, like a pseudo kind of dementia versus, okay, is there really something neurological going on here? That might be an appropriate referral. And we see, you know, we're embedded in geriatrics now, so we see a lot of those folks, and they're pretty good at, you know, managing the meds and managing kind of all the rest of it. So it might be a case by case basis. I can't think of anything sort of immediately offhand or good that makes sense. All right. Well, thank you all so much for your attention and your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Lauren.
Yeah, thank you so much. Sorry, a little long-winded there.
No, it was great. I like the participation, the questions.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I had one of the first primary progressive aphasia patients that I sent to Esalen.
Yeah.
He was still in Boston.
I saw this one question.
Oh.
On, from Pam G.
Okay.
Is there a lasting effect that anesthesia given during surgery
okay.
has? Our mom is going for surgery in this coming weeks.
Okay.
So
can I?
Pam's right here. So I think you're still unmuted. Can you
okay.
hear Pam?
Pam, can you hear me? Okay. Hi. So I would say if she already has some cognitive issues, then that again is going to be a risk factor. So you might see some additional like confusion as the anesthesia wears off. Sometimes folks will have, you know, they can have sort of a postoperative delirium. that can last for a couple days, and you might see some mild cognitive changes, you know, for a couple months after that. But it's not deterministic. Again, it's just if someone has, you know, if someone already has cognitive issues and they also have vascular risk factors, that again, it's a risk factor. You might expect to see some changes, but not deterministic, just something to kind of keep an eye on. And a lot of times folks will pop back. Okay, so you might see like a sharp decline and then some additional improvement back up. Sometimes folks won't quite get back to their baseline. That again suggests to me that there's kind of a vascular piece to it. But so I'd say it's a risk factor, but not absolutely going to happen. It's something to kind of keep an eye on. Okay. You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you to everyone on Zoom. I'm going to close it now, and we will email out a copy to everyone as well as posting it on our website. Thanks for joining us. Can we also come to the next podcast?